Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Scaffold is supported by the Architecture Foundation, bringing new voices to the conversation about architecture in London and around the world. For more information and upcoming events, visit architecturefoundation.org.uk. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and you're listening to Scaffold. In this episode, I speak with the teacher and novelist Leslie Loco, who was recently named as curator of the 2023 Venice Architecture Biennale. Born in Scotland and raised in Ghana, Loco has been influential in academia, where she has worked to reveal the complex relationships between architecture and racial ideology. Her teaching and scholarship is rooted firmly in Africa, where she has established not one, but two new schools of architecture. The first was the Graduate School of Architecture at the University of Johannesburg in 2015, followed by the African Futures Institute in Accra, where she is currently based. She also founded Folio, which is a journal of contemporary African architecture. So it makes sense that Leslie's profile is often framed by her relationship in teaching and organizing. And it's true that in the mainstreaming of Black Lives Matter and the increasing awareness of the need to decolonize curriculums and expand and reconsider the architectural canon, it's teachers like Leslie that we often look to for a framework on how this actually might be achieved. But there's also this other side to Leslie's work that seems at face value totally outside the boundaries of architecture. Leslie is a prolific writer of romance novels. Since 2004, she's written 10 bestsellers, which have been translated into 15 languages. And to me, it was so interesting to talk to Leslie about her approach to writing, which is popular, entertaining, and highly accessible, but often, in this kind of Trojan horse maneuver, brings very challenging issues of race and identity to the reader's attention. Her ability to draw on enticing and unexpected formats to handle these kinds of difficult subjects is really one of the hallmarks of Leslie's work. I reached her in early April 2022. I was in London and she was in Edinburgh, where she was at work on her next novel. So here it is, my conversation with Professor Leslie Loco. So I wanted to start by understanding how you entered architecture initially, and then how you left it.
Yeah, I mean, I should say that it was quite a long-winded approach to architecture because I started off studying Hebrew and Arabic at Oxford, didn't like it, and then left and did sociology in the US. And then it was a chance encounter with somebody, actually, because I was thinking, well, you know, what does one do with a degree in sociology? And I thought, well, I might do law or child psychology. Those were the two things that were floating around. And I worked in Los Angeles, I should say illegally, actually, for some time. For I was an office manager for a man whose company photocopied medical records. And one day he said to me, would I come and help him choose some countertops for a new venture? He wanted to open a chicken restaurant and a dry cleaners. And because my mother had been an art teacher, I knew how to draw, or at least I knew how to draw a perspective. And I think he must have seen me doodling or something one day, and he said, oh, can you come and help me? So we went down to this place, I think it was in Long Beach, California, a warehouse. And I started doing a very quick perspective sketch for him. And he said, you're mad. Why do you want to study law? You should be an architect. And I suddenly thought, well, yeah, why not? I mean, I didn't know any architects. And, you know, at that time, in the UK, it didn't matter that you'd done a degree before. You had to go back to year one. So I applied to the Bartlett from LA and eventually got in. And I think at the time I thought I was going to learn something quite deep. You know, I was sort of fed up knowing a little bit about a lot of things. I thought architecture would teach me something really profound about one thing. And I remember Stephen Groak and David Dunster were my the two people who interviewed me. They've both passed away since. And I think it was Stephen Groak said, if you think that you're going to leave here knowing a lot about one thing, come and talk to me in 5 years' time. And he passed away before I finished at the Bartlett, unfortunately. But actually, I think he was absolutely right. I knew less when I left than when I'd started. And I think part of that was to do with wanting intuitively to talk about questions of race and power and identity and not finding an easy space within architecture, especially then. I mean, this is probably nearly 30 years ago. And I actually left before I finished my PhD. I left in 2000 to start writing fiction, and I only finished the PhD in 2007. So for a time I was doing both fiction and the PhD, which was a bit mad.
I want to understand more about this particular moment in your education where you set out to write this book and met what sounds like a kind of barrier lack of further inquiry or some kind of obstacle that diverted your attention towards becoming a novelist. I just want to, if you could bring us back to that particular moment of, first of all, writing White Papers, Black Marks, then the outcome of that experience and how that led you to leave the discipline temporarily.
Yeah. I suppose I would say it began to occur to me probably in second year at the Bartlett, where the word culture was being thrown around a lot. And what I understood by culture, I couldn't see it reflected in what was being presented to me. So it seemed as if there was a very fixed, universal understanding of culture, you know, the kind of canonical texts and the references and the precedents and so on. But I knew that I came from a place that didn't have that reference point. And I remember, maybe it was right at the beginning of second year, maybe it was even first year, sort of opening up Bannister Fletcher. Yes. And looking at the Tree of Architecture and realizing Africa wasn't on it. And thinking, I remember thinking to myself, it's either a deliberate omission or we don't have anything like that. But you know, I grew up in Ghana. I mean, we did have things like that. Or we did have a kind of a building and material and a formal culture. So when I first started tentatively talking, it was actually talking about culture, not really race. But I understood very quickly in the UK that the only way to talk about my culture would be to talk about it through the lens of race. So in Ghana, I could talk about being Ghanaian, but in the UK, I could only talk about being black. And they're not the same thing at all. I mean, there's a relationship. And so the more I sort of looked at that area, the more people were encouraging me to look at music or film or literature. And it seemed as if constantly the references were trying to draw me away from architecture. And I remember somebody, an archaeologist, saying something to me, maybe I was in third year, which eventually became the title, I think, of the first piece that I published, which was an archaeological term called argument from silence, which in archaeology means that you dig somewhere, but just because you don't find anything doesn't mean nothing happened. So I remember he, and I don't remember who it was now, unfortunately, explaining to me that what you're doing in architecture is essentially an argument from silence. There is something there, but it just hasn't been found yet. And then by the time I got into diploma, sort of the master's level at the Bartlett, I found a much easier home, in a sense, to explore those ideas. You know, the diploma was very free. So it was the first time I realised that if something wasn't there, my work could make it manifest. But there was also quite a lot of... fear is too strong a word, but I think I was quite shy in many cases to come out right and say, look, I'm black and therefore I'm doing this work about being black. There was a lot of ambivalence and I think insecurity about doing that. So it took me quite a while to find the confidence to say, you know, this is not about me personally. And I think that's the way many people read it, especially then, that, you know, this is about somebody trying to tell her personal story, which it wasn't. And I think that's in the end why I thought, you know, it's too difficult to continuously explain why you're trying to explore something. At some point, you just have to kind of get on with it. And eventually, I just thought architecture is not going to be the, or it was too hard to find the space to explore freely, and fiction seemed to be a much more forgiving space.
I mean, the reason why I'm interested in this particular moment, this kind of crossroads early on, for you, is that I imagine so many young practitioners and students of architecture are right now experiencing precisely the same thing.
Yeah.
Where despite supposed advancements or progressions in the culture of architecture, there's still, and I think this has been accelerated by the pandemic as well as Black Lives Matter and this real concern for equity in the discipline, that it just can't accommodate everyone, or it's just, in a way, it's not a big enough house for everyone. And so I'm increasingly hearing architects and students describe ambitions to develop careers that are somehow adjacent to architecture, where they have more autonomy or control, which is, in a way, what you did, except at face value, becoming a novelist seems like a very sharp veer away from architecture, especially the kind of novels that you decided to write. You've described them yourself as
sex
being
and shopping.
about sex and shopping. Mm-hmm. These are blockbuster novels. You pick up at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
They're romantic.
Mm-hmm.
They're thrilling. And I want to know more about what drew you, first of all, to fiction, but also this particular genre.
So, you know, there's a kind of off-the-cuff answer to that, and then there's a slightly, I think, more thoughtful answer. So I'll give you the off-the-cuff answer first, which was, it was quite a calculated decision to earn some money. And I sort of looked around at the genres that seemed most likely to earn, you know, literary fiction, unless, you know, you're a Zadie Smith, or, you know, it's unlikely that you're going to make millions from it. But commercial fiction, it's quite possible to earn a really good living. So the first impetus was commercial. But I've always been interested in beauty and in aesthetics and in seduction, because I understood, I think even as a student, that one way to draw people into towards your work was to not be afraid of beauty, to not be afraid. I think Kevin Rowbottom was one of the first people who said to me, if you want to say something radical or something different, understand that seduction will also be a tool. So I was very keen, I think even as a student, not for people not to see my work through the lens, number one, of racism. I'm very interested in race as a creative category. Yes, it is political, but it's not a protest category. And I've always believed that the imagination is the most powerful tool that we have. So I was very determined to tackle those questions imaginatively, not just politically or economically or even socially. So when I started writing fiction and writing these novels, the idea of sexual attraction in the novel between protagonists for me was a very interesting way to understand how we view the other, what are the kind of psychological and emotional and social and political and all of those kinds of things, forces at play, because they're not unlike the same forces that are at play when we deal with space or form or material or aesthetics. So I think a lot of people assume that the novels are very, very different. And actually they're not. For me, it's a very similar topic. It just happens to be a different medium that you test the same kind of ideas about self and other, about here and there, about what it means to be inside and outside and all those kinds of things. So for me, it was just another language. And I think I've always understood architecture as very narrative driven. So the novels were not so, they were not so different.
You described at some point falling into a rhythm in your writing where, in your words, you were a kind of bee a B writer, a B-list writer. And because it's a kind of writing that's commercially driven, even though you are dealing with these really potent and complex issues around identity and race and the way, I guess, we relate to each other and define ourselves in relation, because it's a commercial kind of literature, you get locked into a certain pattern.
Yeah.
That in order for your work to remain lucrative,
yeah,
because it's understood by your audience in a certain way, there's a certain formula to the romance novel that you have to adhere to, or your agents seem to kind of encourage you to adhere to. And even the way the books are represented, I mean, a lot of the covers are almost identical, and they feature usually a woman seemingly on vacation on a beach in a sarong.
And there's often no beach or no sarong or no vacation in the novel. No, absolutely.
With like a pink sunset or something.
Yeah.
So at some point, it sounds like another barrier presented itself with this medium, where in order to remain a kind of creative vessel for you, it had to change, or it had to, at least for the time being, stop.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. We bang on the money. And I mean, I think, you know, especially for my British publishers, it was such a conundrum. And it's been so interesting because the novels have been translated in quite a lot of languages. And there's certain markets where they've succeeded and other markets where they, you know, I think I got one published in the United States and, you know, that was the end of it.
It seems like it's doing very well in Italy.
Italy's a good market. I mean, Italy's probably, relative to the size of the market, it's probably my best market. And it's kind of interesting because my editor in Italy is Bulgarian by birth, but grew up in Milan. And she got it immediately. She understood what the novels were about and what they were trying to do. And she understood the relationship between the subject matter and the genre. And my Italian novels are probably the only ones that I would be seen dead on a plane reading myself. The covers are, yeah. But it was also very interesting for me that in territories where class is very kind of strongly present, there was less ability to maneuver between genres because the kind of class structure is very fixed. So in the UK, it was very, very firmly understood that these were commercial fiction, that they had titles that were alliterative, you know, lots of double S's and so on. Lots of the titles had S in them. Or, you know, pink was supposed to sell very well. And there was a very fixed view of who the reader was. And my fan mail, you know, which when I started, there was quite a lot of it, tended to fall into two distinct camps. Probably 5% of the people who read the novels reached out and said, I so understand what you're trying to do. 95% of the people wrote back and said, "Oh, I love, you know, love the sex and shopping, love the exotic locations. Do you know that the 73 bus does not stop on the corner of XYZ?" You know, people they really read you and tell you that. And I remember saying something about that to, I think it was to one of my editors at the time. And she said to me, "You're just going to have to accept that there's something slightly Cassandra-like about what you're saying, which is that you're clearly writing for an audience that hasn't quite caught up yet." Mm. And this was about 20 years ago, and I actually really didn't understand what she meant. When I came back from Spitzer, you know, after having resigned, after Black Lives Matter, and I got in touch with my agent, who's still my agent, and she said to me, "Now's the time. You need to write again." And it's as if the outside world has suddenly caught up. And I guess that's what the person was telling me 20 years ago. That, but this is still not the right genre for its time. Yeah.
So Spitzer, this is the City University of New York,
yeah,
School of Architecture, where you were dean from 2019 to 2020. The term was 5 years, but you left
about 5 months
early for a myriad of reasons. But in summary, it seemed like there was a profound lack of administrative support, compounded by this kind of perfect storm of administrative stress and the burden, I think, of handling a highly charged and racialized situation at the school as well. You said that leaving that post for you as an act of self-preservation. I mean, I don't, in a way, I feel like this could be exhausting for you to recount detail, but...
It's very, very quick, and it's, for me, it was very, very clear. And when I said that I would have died if I'd stayed there, and I mean, I'm not exaggerating, I mean very simply that wherever you have gender, race and labour, particularly in the United States, you have a much more complex set of paradigms than you would in other places. So for me, the lack of administrative or faculty or collegial support simply meant that I perceived it, I'm the only one who perceived it, people might have had a different view on it, that the people would have seen me work myself to death, because that's what black women do. So for me, there was just no possibility that I was going to take up that burden. So as far as I was concerned, out. This is not what I signed up for. And it wasn't that people came out of their offices and, you know, called me racist slurs. No, I don't mean that at all. I just mean that there's something very deep and problematic about the combination of those three things that I just didn't feel was my burden to carry.
So I'm conscious we've jumped ahead a little in this chronology in a way. I kind of want to go. No, it's okay. I want to go back and have you talk us through the moment where you at least put your career as a novelist on hold to re-enter the discipline of architecture.
Yes, I wrote, I think it was 10 or 11 novels, you know, in fairly quick succession for about 10, 12, maybe 13 years. It was usually one novel a year. And I think, as you sort of said earlier, at a certain point, I began to get a little bit kind of creatively restless. And the novels sold well, but not well enough that I could kind of rewrite the rules. So I was a good solid earner within a certain kind of formula. And after the 10th or the 11th novel, I thought, oh, I want to try something different. And I just felt there wasn't room to do it. I mean, in the same way that I thought there hadn't been room in architecture to explore certain things. And it was a chance meeting with somebody at a university in Holland. And I used to still do little bits and pieces of architectural, you know, lecturing or giving talks or something. But I wasn't employed anywhere. And I was part of this conference. I think it was called African Perspectives in Delft. And I met someone who then asked me very quickly if I would be an external examiner for a program in South Africa, for a master's program. And I said, yes. I flew out, did the reviews. And then when I got back, he emailed and said, look, we're looking for an opening for a professor. Do you know anyone in your networks who might be interested? And I just looked at the email for a few minutes and I thought, oh, why not? So I applied and got the job. And then as soon as I landed, as soon as I started work, I realized that the original job that I'd been hired for, the university or the department, didn't actually have the capacity to do. But there was something very interesting happening in South Africa at that time. There were student protests and blah, blah, blah. So I wasn't hired to start a graduate school of architecture, but I took an existing master's program and turned it into something else and did that for 5 years, but was, again, really bedeviled by the lack of administrative support. And when Michael Sorkin came calling, I had a very difficult year personally in 2019. My sister died, and then a few weeks later, my brother died, which was just, like a thunderbolt. And I just thought to myself, if I stay here 18 hours a day, that may be my fate. And so when Michael came calling, I thought, okay, well, move to the States, maybe do one term as dean, and make the kind of philanthropic connections that you need, and then come back to Ghana to set up a school. And then, resigning just brought that forward, by 4 years and 6 months or whatever it was. Yeah.
So just going back to your work in Johannesburg, am I right in understanding that you actually did set up the Graduate School of Architecture? That's what your job became. And I think in the midst of establishing this new program, there was a series of student protests, or at least this was in 2015, 2016. So if I've got my time frame wrong. Please correct me.
No, so I mean, I arrived in 2014 and I was an associate professor in the Department of Architecture, which had a very, very new master's program. But it was struggling to recruit students. I think there were 11 students, all white. And, you know, the beginnings of the rumblings of decolonization were already happening. I mean, this is even before The Roads Must Fall. So there was a kind of move towards, you know, an opening up of the canon, of the curriculum. And there was also a real, you know, really intense drive to recruit more black students because many departments, I mean, architecture has very poor representation of black students or practitioners in South Africa.
So it's this cultural moment, a profound upheaval.
Yeah, exactly.
And you've mentioned elsewhere that the one great achievement of your time at the GSA was your ability to turn the impulse from destruction to production.
Yeah.
And your ability to somehow work productively with violence. Could you talk more about, I guess, the political context of the work you were doing at the GSA and how, in fact, you were able to turn that impulse away from the destructive forces of the protests themselves into something productive that the school itself was doing?
Yeah, I mean, I should say that it certainly wasn't only me. I think there were two things that happened. One was that just out of necessity, many of the tutors were very young. And so they were quite close to their own source of anger and frustration, which was very interesting because they'd graduated, but didn't have the kind of devil-may-care attitude of many of the students whose impulse was to burn, let's say, to tear down. And the other thing was that, you know, when I think back to my experience at the Bartlett, particularly in the master's, the diploma program, the very open-ended nature of the unit system, which meant a small group of students in dialogue with two tutors around specific interests, could allow you to explore something. And particularly because you often had a year, sometimes 2 years, you could afford to get things wrong. You could make wrong moves, you could learn from mistakes, which under a semester system, it's very, very difficult to do. That, you know, you start with an idea and then 6 weeks later you've got to draw a plan and a section. So the unit system as a methodology really allowed me to find my own voice. So it was a kind of stroke of luck that, you know, the protest happened, the pressure to come up with a new way of doing things was almost immediate. And I had this ready-made methodology that I knew instinctively would work here because it had worked for me 30 years or 25 years earlier. So that combination of a political opening up, very young students, an existing methodology, and 25 years of thinking about these things, it kind of was a perfect storm in a different way. And when we implemented the unit system, we went overnight from 11 to 52 students. And the university just suddenly woke up and thought, okay, this is a goer. And so I was able to get the funding and the support and to really just drive the program through. But it was always administration that was the devil. And, you know, it's difficult to fundraise, to teach. And because I had to, I mean, I ran a unit as well as running the school, as well as doing research, as well as fundraising, as well as picking people up from the airport. It was mad.
Oh, my God.
But in some ways, it was the only way to do it because no one there had ever been in a unit system before.
When you say unit system, I'm sure most listeners will understand what that means. But for those who don't, this is a way of structuring our architectural education where there is a heterogeneous mix of tutors, each with their own approach and their own studio, which students can select to participate in. And this was established, I mean, maybe it's not entirely accurate to say, but my understanding of the origins of this type of teaching is in the AA with
people like
Alan Boyarsky. I mean, he was the originator of it,
This is in the 1970s?
Yeah.
So, and it's since, I think, spread across the UK and North America, and it sounds like you brought this mode of teaching to Johannesburg as well. In the establishment of the GSA. I want to talk more about pedagogy and about new forms of teaching. in regards to the African Futures Institute, which is the new venture.
Yeah. I mean, it will be a school, but at the moment it's an institute. Yeah.
After your tenure at the GSA, you had this, as we discussed, brief brief stint in the U.S. at CUNY, and following that, set out again to establish a new school of architecture, essentially the African Futures Institute, which to me is a kind of boggling ambition, regardless of where a new school would be. The fact that one could conceive of building a new school from scratch is to me overwhelming and also exciting, but mainly overwhelming. But I think also in the context of this particularly fraught moment in our culture where schools are having to rethink the way they teach. And it sounds like instead of working from within an existing institution, the impulse was for you to start from the beginning again. And I wondered if you could talk me through kind of early thoughts or conversations you've been having about how, in fact, one does this. And also talk more about why this new institute is situated in Accra, Ghana.
So, I mean, I'm from Accra. That's where I grew up. And I knew for quite a long time that I would probably eventually go home. So I went home in 2002, I think, when I got my first novel contract, bought a piece of land, built a house, decided to stay. And I stayed for quite a long time writing, but, you know, Accra's quite a difficult town to write in. That the formula is that people send you a text. If they don't get you, they phone you. If they don't get you, they come to your house. And if you're not there, they wait for you. So it was quite a hard place to claw away time.
I've heard, you write in Edinburgh, where you know you will not be disturbed.
Yeah, I used to run away to Edinburgh all the time to do it. That's what I'm doing now. But the GSA, you know, even though there was an existing master's program, I mean, this was a new venture from scratch. It had a separate budget. It was a very new thing. And in some senses, you know, it wasn't that complex. You know, you start small. You are very clear about what you want to do. You invest quite a lot of time in the kind of branding of the idea. And, you know, you find money. I quite like fundraising in many ways. So the GSA was a really good pilot. And when I left Spitzer in January 2021, which was last year, I thought to myself, well, you're nearly 60 now. If you don't go home and start this now, you probably won't. And I couldn't imagine gearing up to go back into another institution. I mean, I thought you'll just go and find the same thing. So I was actually in Edinburgh and walking around one day, and I came across the Edinburgh Futures Institute, which is a new institute that's attached to the University of Edinburgh. And at the moment, it's kind of like a building site, but there are a couple of courses. And I suddenly thought, well, I really like that name. And I was clear that it wouldn't be a school only, because one of the things that was really interesting about the GSA was Johannesburg had quite a small architectural community, but also not a very vibrant architectural culture. You know, it's quite a small community, so people don't critique each other, because you're going to wind up sitting at a dinner party with the person that you've poked holes at their project or whatever. So people are very coded about what they say about one another. And the general population, partly because of the racial divide, most architects are white, it's changing a little bit, but not much, means that there's a whole swathe of the population who really have no say in architecture, even though they live in and amongst it. But when we got some funding from a really generous benefactor to set up an international lecture series, I mean, that really was a game changer, I think, for the city, because suddenly every Thursday, you know, Ajay was coming, Bjark Engels, Aravena, I mean, all of these kind of architectural figures that the students there see as much as students anywhere else. And that was very interesting for me. So when I thought, okay, we'll start something new in Accra, I thought it should have a public events program similar to what we did at the GSA. There should be a research component and there should be a school. And I never imagined the school being a big school. a graduate-only school, not more than 100 students. And the eventual idea was to have about 50% of them from Ghana, 25% from the continent of Africa, and 25% international. And Ford Foundation and the Mellon Foundation were absolutely fantastic. I worshipped the ground, you know, both of their leaders walk on. And then suddenly the Biennale popped up. And it certainly wasn't on my radar. And so we pivoted away.
And just, sorry, to step in, you're referring to your being appointed as
the curator of
the 2023 Venice Architecture Biennale.
Yeah. So that happened in December last year. So I realized, you know, you can't continue preparing for an academic program with this. It's an enormous job. So what we did was pivot the AFI away from the teaching program or the beginnings of it to a research team. So I've now got 10 young African or diasporic researchers who are working with me. So part of what they do is directly for the AFI, and part of it is to do with the upcoming Biennale. And the idea is that when the Biennale is over in November 2023, I will probably collapse for 6 months and then start the academic program in August 2024. So that's the kind of trajectory. But it will always be small.
And in terms of how, maybe it's too early to understand yet how the program itself will be set up or how it will differentiate itself from these kind of standard Western models. I mean, in part, it's simply to do, it sounds like, with the makeup of the student body, of demographics. But I imagine there are also teaching methodologies or the structure of the curriculum, the format through which it's delivered that you're deliberating on.
Yeah.
I mean, is it too early to talk about those kinds of ideas?
No, not at all. I mean, the first decision was to make it a non-validated, non-accredited program. So in some senses, it would be like, I guess, a post-professional program. It is interdisciplinary in the sense that it's not only architects will be admitted to the program. And it'll run, certainly in its first five-year iteration or as long as I'm around, like a series of, I guess you'd call them units, where there's not such a strong distinction between design, history and theory, sustainability, technology. So there really are kind of like laboratory environments for thinking about the future of the discipline. And one of the equations that has been at the back of my mind, I think probably for about 30 years, is that when I came to architecture as a student, the equation or the relationship seemed to be that as an African, as a black person, there was nothing about my culture that was of use to architecture, that somehow we were too poor or too corrupt or too chaotic or whatever the tropes were. And now after 30 years, I see this is the complete opposite. I think there's something about the condition of the African continent, for one thing, but also the diaspora, which is too complex for the discipline as we see it. I'm not talking about the profession.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, this is a line of thought I've heard you present in lectures and interviews as well, that it's really the discipline itself that is impoverished.
Yeah.
And it is so helpful to be able to frame the problem that way. But in a sense, the struggle then is how one solves that problem by restructuring the discipline, which is what the AFI is setting out to do.
Yep. And I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, it's an opportunity to position. And when I say ourselves, I mean it in a very, very broad way, at the kind of center of thought production, not always, you know, as the consumers of it. And to say that there is something rich and meaningful and generous in these histories and experiences and contexts that have been outside of Western canon for so long. And I've said it so many times, I sound like a broken record, but I really do see decolonization or decolonizing the curriculum as a gift. It's not a weapon. And so for me, this addition expands, you know, the discipline as we know it. It doesn't contract it or replace it.
Mm. Just on that point of decolonization, in some of your lectures, you present a video of a seminar you conducted at the GSA in Johannesburg, which was called Safe Space.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which I've watched, and in a way it reminds me of other tactics or other tactics or approaches to beginning this pursuit of decolonizing the educational system by creating an opportunity for students and teachers to voice their opinions and insights and critiques and frustrations in a context within which they know they won't be punished or ostracized.
Yeah.
Penalized. And watching these seminars, which are structured in a way like a reality TV show, you hired a filmmaker to document these various sessions. And I mean, it's even to the point where you have a soundtrack and all the tropes of the reality TV show where the contestants enter and leave a space and the kind of one-to-one interviews. It makes me think of your books, actually, in terms of how you find a format for embedding very difficult ideas in a way that, forgive me for saying this, but goes down easy.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, you're absolutely spot on there. And I mean...
Because I have to say, like, it's so hard to watch these conversations. I mean, I'm sure, you know, speaking from my perspective as a white man, obviously difficult to talk about race in most contexts without putting my finger in it. But I think for anyone sitting in on those meetings or anyone watching, there's so much that would elicit a kind of cringe, depending on who's speaking and about what. It is so uncomfortable to see, but at the same time, you found this kind of vessel for these discussions that that smooths it over and makes it consumable. And I think on first impression, especially an architectural audience, would see that kind of work as being lowbrow, for example, or unsophisticated.
In the same way
that maybe an uninitiated audience would see your novels as being. But in fact, it is so, to me, so exciting to think of these projects both in terms of format and content. And I think it's the format that to me is so ingenious for delivering content, which is very, very difficult to grapple with. So one other point I just want to kind of bring into this part of the discussion is the fact that I've been listening to you talk to students and academics in the U.S. You've been there recently. You were a Loeb Fellow at the Harvard Graduate School of Design, where you delivered a lecture last month. You also delivered a lecture at RISD, Rhode Island School of Design. And in these conversations, students will ask you questions. And there are questions that are very difficult for you to understand. Because of, I guess, the ways in which the format for discussing racism and inequality is so different, that there's a kind of paralysis, which is then masked by very complex language.
Yeah, no, I mean,
that in fact makes very little sense.
You're so right. I mean, it's a really beautiful kind of analysis of the situation. And I think, you know, I'll say one thing first and then come back very specifically to the US in a second. But I remember in South Africa at the GSA, there was a group of black students who I literally couldn't understand anything they said. When they talked about their projects, it just drifted into... It was just babble. And after doing a little bit of digging, it turned out that there had been a class that those students had taken where a book was given to them. I think it's called Archie Speak,
yes.
And I'm not sure exactly what happened in that class, but it seemed to me as if the book was taught as if it was not ironic. So the book is ironic. And in this context, I think it was taught as if it was serious. And I remember coming away from those four or five students who all were quite gifted, so angry, because I thought what had happened was that they had been doubly robbed of language.
Mm.
And actually, there was no, at least in my view, there was no saving them. Like, they'd gone so far down that path that, like, it was so convoluted. And when we did Safe Space, there was something about the extreme emotions that were being forced to the surface that managed to kind of pierce that veil, not for all of them, but for some of them. And for the first time, I think some of them managed to connect anger and shame and guilt and all of these kinds of emotions that are not really supposed to be present in the academy, because those are the things that you leave outside. And this is what I mean about it being productive. If they were able to take the emotion or the passion, whether that was anger, jealousy, rage, fear, whatever it was, and use that as the catalyst to ask questions or to stretch definitions or to pull language apart, it worked. If it remained as anger and it came into contact with situations or briefs or projects that were all about injustice and anger, you could never get past it. It was like a double reinforcement. When I got to the States, I could see the same frustration in the students and I could hear it in their voices, but they were always corralled into doing projects that were of the same anger that they were trying to grapple with. So again, they just wound up in this double bind where the more they investigated, the angrier they got, the less able they were to work, the angrier they got. And there's a very difficult way, I think, of talking about a race and class and power in the US, which, let me be careful how I say this. There's an aspect to it which is un-American. It is unpatriotic to talk about one's own context in that way. And for many African American or diasporic students, if you reveal that anger, it's like you leave them with nothing. It's like you're saying, not only are you angry at belonging here, but if you really investigate that anger, there will be nowhere else to belong to. So there's a kind of fear attached to it, because you want to write yourself both out and into the same history or the same experiences that you're discussing. So it's very complex. And I've found that using a vessel, whether that's the reality TV show or the sex and shopping novel or the thing that's not like the thing that you're trying to do, it's not exactly a Trojan horse, but it is a vessel that will carry, it'll carry the emotion that must come to the surface. I think, yeah, I think you said it all already. Yeah.
So now that we're on this topic of vessels and of format, I want to talk about the culture of architecture exhibitions. So, as listeners will know, you've been appointed as the curator for the 2023 Venice Architecture Biennale, and you're under, I will say, strict embargo to discuss any details around your involvement in it. And I won't venture into that at all. But I do want to talk about the culture of exhibitions more broadly, in relation to, first of all, the fact that the exhibition is itself a kind of vessel for producing and disseminating knowledge. There's also a format to the exhibition that we're all quite familiar with, which I think recently curators have been able to kind of subvert more effectively. But I want to understand your attitude towards the exhibition, broadly speaking, as it relates to a particular phenomena that you've often articulated in the talks you've given. And this is the phenomena of the double consciousness. So I don't think you reference W.E.B. Du Bois directly when you talk about the double consciousness, but I mean, it's in effect this experience of always looking at oneself through the eyes of a racist white society. And I think in your use of this idea of double consciousness, it's that pressure of the designer or the architect to explore a world in all its depth at the same time you're trying to explain it. And so I just want to read, there's a passage from a novel by the South African novelist Jam Kotsi. Can you remind me, sorry, what the novel is called? I'm missing it from my notes.
Elizabeth Costello.
Elizabeth Costello. I just want to read it out because I feel like it very succinctly articulates this experience of double consciousness that you're describing. And of course, you've referenced this quote as well. So the English novel is written in the first place by English people for English people. And that is what makes it the English novel. The Russian novel is written by Russians for Russians. But the African novel is not written by Africans for Africans. African novelists may write about Africa, about African experiences, but they seem to be glancing over their shoulders the whole time they write at the foreigners who read them. Whether they like it or not, they have accepted the role of interpreter, interpreting Africa to their readers. To me, this is such a lucid description of the conundrum that a lot of African and diasporic architects and designers also face. And we could look to, let's say, the Serpentine, for example. You have someone like Bjark Ingels, who is liberated to perform all these formal investigations with new materials. Whereas recently, for example, with Francis Carré or Tatiana Bilbel, the onus is, seems to be more on interpreting one's cultural background and representing it to a Western audience. And I don't know to what degree that decision is subconscious or how willingly designers like Carré or Bilbao generate those kind of pavilions. Carré, I think, was referencing a tree and the sense of community that formed around it in his hometown in Burkina Faso.
Yep.
Bilbao is referencing in her pavilion the domestic Mexican architecture and this kind of breeze block construction. So there you can see this kind of interpretation taking place through installations like that, where it's the foreign architect, in this case, representing their culture back to a Western audience. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on that conundrum and what to you are some possible ways around or out of that struggle. In a way, to this is the question you pose, and I just want to put it again out there. The question is, how can you explore a world in all its depth at the same time as you explain it?
So I think, and maybe this goes back to what I was saying about the poverty in the discipline and not the poverty in the context. I think that the conventional tools of architectural representation, you know, the drawing, the manifesto, the film, you know, the photograph, they can only do so much in the service of that. I call it a translation as well as a kind of double consciousness, because not only are you aware of being looked at, but you somehow have to do something with that awareness, and that awareness seeps into your work, it seeps into the way where you think, the way you make, etc. But rather than see it as, or I think I've chosen now, rather than see it as only a problem that I somehow have to overcome, I prefer now to see it as a tactic. And I've spoken about this recently, maybe in the last 2 or 3 years, where I see many of the tools that I've been taught less as tools and more as tactics. And the byproduct or the result of constantly thinking tactically is that you become quite strategic. I find that, you know, I'm not a management consultant, and I certainly didn't sign up for leadership roles, but I can also see how the experiences I've had have made it almost impossible to do anything other than lead in some senses. So there's been some, I guess, yeah, there's been a kind of expanding or a widening of my own skill set, is the way I could call it. And it, that comes with responsibilities and challenges and drawbacks and all the rest of it. But it really is an amazing gift, I think. And about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago at the AFI in Accra, we have one of the lecture series is called the Pan-African Speaker Series. And we had Issa Diabate, who's from our neighbouring country in Côte d'Ivoire, and he came over to give a talk. And at some point in the talk, he said, you know, I've recently come to understand that I am no longer the future. And in a way, I feel very much like that, that I'm no longer the future, but that expanded tool set and expanded field that I have operated in most of my life has given me something that's of use to the generation that's coming behind, which is why I think no matter what, no matter how I end up earning my living, I think I'm first and foremost a teacher. I mean, that's, or a pedagogue, or whatever you want to say. So there is something about this very neat bringing back a full circle in a way. It's as if the right tools and the right tactics have combined in the right place to do the right thing. So for that, I can only be really appreciative, I think. And, you know, there is, I can't remember the phrase it is, that women watch men and men watch women, women watching them, or something like that. I mean, it's a little bit similar to double consciousness, but it's this idea that you are always aware of yourself as an object at the same time you're a subject. And that ability to look front and back and side and up and down kind of simultaneously, you know, for an architect is a gift. It's a really unique way, I think, of seeing the world. And I could see it very, very clearly in my South African students, particularly Black students, that the genius of the school, and it certainly wasn't mine, it was in those young tutors, you know, the Samayas, the Sarahs, the Huda Tayobs, the Thresh Govendas, the people who started teaching very, very quickly after graduating. The moment they were able to articulate a brief for a student in a way such that the knowledge, the experience that that student had that was different from white or middle class or suburban or whatever you want to call it students, that was the moment that the playing field was leveled, because suddenly the white students could see that there was something in what the Black students were saying that came directly out of their lived experiences that they would have to learn. They would have to learn how to do. In the same way that Black students, for so long, had been looking at what white students were doing, and this is not to do with race per se, this is much more to do with class and kind of culture. They had to learn that. The minute there was a reflexive two-way learning, that's when the game opened, I think. Yeah.
I just want to ask one more question before I let you go. And it's again to do with this culture of exhibition, which, thinking more about it, has its roots in the culture of the World's Fair, in a way. I'm thinking of the Crystal Palace.
Yeah.
And how that endeavor became a kind of cabinet of exotic curiosities.
Yeah.
I think that's what I'm getting at when I talk about the way that
exhibition,
African and diasporic architects now maybe face some pressure, whether it's subconscious or overt, to present their culture as yet another exotic curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, without speaking directly about the Biennale, if we can talk about, in more concrete terms, how one goes about dismantling this Western system of representation, which frames mm-hmm. foreignness or otherness in a way that reinforces
mm-hmm.
Arguably the dominance of Western culture, or reinforces a certain idea of whiteness.
Mm-hmm.
That dismantles that and kind of reassembles it into a new form.
Yeah.
This is, of course, in relation to an idea or a quote from the theorist Bell Hooks that's been circulated widely, which is that one cannot dismantle the master's house using the master's tools. So tell me more about these other tools, these new tools, which will help you reform the exhibition culture. And I think also, as I'm saying this, I'm just realizing the unimaginable weight I'm also just placing on you and asking that question. As if one curator alone can begin to do that.
No, that's not how it works at all, no. And I mean, in a way, it's that old conundrum that you can't be outside of history whilst critiquing it. You're inside it, you know, you're inside the thing all the time. And I mean, I can't actually say too much about the tools of the exhibition because it'll be giving a bit of a game away. But I will say this, which is, it's just something we put onto our Instagram page this morning. We have a research project going on called Pinpoint. And one of the images that we're working with is, you can probably, readers can probably go and look it up, the African Futures Institute on Instagram. But there's an image with a James Baldwin quote, which I think says something like, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. And I think that's very much where I see this phase of let's call it decolonization, which is that no single event, no single exhibition, no single book, person is going to flip this entirely. But what all of those things do cumulatively is switch the dial just a little bit, a little bit, a little bit. And I really do think that change happens both incrementally and then suddenly very rapidly. I mean, if I'm to look back over the past 30 years, I would say that is exactly how this has happened. And often you are too close to the event to be able to see it historically. And I suspect that's probably going to be true of many events like new exhibitions, not just the Biennale. But in 5 or 10 years' time, I think we may be able to look back and see that was the point at which a pivot did turn. And I think, for me, the relationship between, you know, carbon and colony is such an interesting one. And it's no surprise, in a sense, that, you know, the pandemic and the protests happened simultaneously or almost simultaneously. And the kind of increasing anxiety about climate change, but also the increasing threat of kind of global stability. Like this is a real watershed moment in lots of different ways. I think an exhibition at this time in some ways will have to speak to those conditions, for it to have resonance. I think there's a wonderful quote, it's by one of my favorite writers, Nadine Gordimer, and it's about the relationship between relevance and commitment. And that, you know, the artist, or in the widest possible sense of the word, is always working between these two impulses. And, you know, it's the pulse that goes back and forth between an artist and the society. You know, does this have relevance, and do I have the commitment to put it in, to bring it into being? Yeah.
Leslie, thank you so much for your time.
It's a total pleasure. Great questions. It was really enjoyable.
You've been listening to Scaffold. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and I produce the show. The theme music is composed and performed by Luke Blair. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @scaffold_podcast. If you like the show, spread the word and leave a rating on iTunes while you're at it. Thanks to Leslie Loco. Special thanks this week to Nana Biema Ofusu and Ellis Woodman. Thanks as always to Scandal Lynn, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time.
When we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.